Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection, originating from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. In 2010, President Barack Obama signed the Affordable Care Act into law. The act had the purpose of improving cost, quality, and access to health care in the United States. Now we're 6 years later, 20 million more people have health insurance. The rate of increase in health care costs have declined, and health care quality has evidence that it's improving. Not all is rosy, however. The planned health insurance exchange has not been as successful as is hoped, and prescription drug costs are rapidly rising. In addition, the Affordable Care Act had also encouraged alternative payment models for physicians. And then in 2015, just last year, a bipartisan group encouraged an expanded payment for Medicare patients through the Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act called MACRA. In this situation, physician payments are tied to quality and some other factors, and really not just for fee-for-service. The hope is that changes in how healthcare providers are paid will improve cost and quality of care. However, it should be kept in mind that there's pretty good evidence that health appears to depend more on socioeconomic factors than healthcare. So the idea should be kept in mind that health and healthcare are not synonymous. In this Line One program, we're going to discuss the origins and expected effects as we move away from fee-for-service in Medicare with Dr. Nancy Fisher. Dr. Fisher is the Region 10 Chief Medical Officer for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and she's joining us by telephone from her office in Seattle. Prior to becoming the Chief Medical Officer, she got her MD degree at Baylor College of Medicine, got an MPH at the University of Washington, served briefly as the Regents Blue Shield Medical Director in the Seattle area, was director of the Healthcare Authority for Washington State for 7 years, and for 1 year prior to joining Medicare as their chief medical officer, was president of the board of directors of the American Heart Association. Dr. Fisher, I expect that you are one of the very busy people in Seattle, and I really, really appreciate your taking the time to join us here today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I feel really privileged to have the opportunity to have a discussion about healthcare and healthcare needs and what we can do.
Thank you. So let's come back before we talk about changes and why they're needed in healthcare. I love this concept that we need to keep in mind that there's a difference between health and healthcare, and that the evidence suggests that health, which might be surprising to many people, that health is more dependent on socioeconomic factors than on healthcare. And we can talk about how much money we spend in each of those areas in a second as we talk about what we're trying to do with healthcare. But does that make sense to you? Have you heard this idea before? And is it important to put it in some perspective as we begin to talk about healthcare and what we need to do about it?
Well, what we need to remember that we need both aspects to look at improving our healthcare system. And what good would it do if you get diagnosed with a disease and you have no way to get access to the care, either because you don't have any money for transportation or you can't afford the treatment? So we know that when you look at the socioeconomic status of people, especially the economic, no matter if you're in our system or in the Canadian system of healthcare or in the European where people have open access, it's poverty that is one thing that has to be eliminated in order to get more equal access and to improve the small part of the population there that really doesn't have access to health care. We know that we have to look at these social determinants of care. Just think about it. Where you live, what are you exposed to? We looked at lead exposure for kids and paint, and we knew that that's a problem. That has to do with the environment. We know that there's problems about people that lived over nuclear waste deposits. And we know that when you start looking, you say we should eat more fresh food rather than buying processed food. Studies have shown that a lot of people can't buy fresh food because it costs more. Mm-hmm. We also learn that you need physical activity. You need to keep moving. Well, if you think about what we hear about crime and other murders and stuff, there's neighborhoods where you shouldn't be out walking. People stay in the house. So this has a direct effect mm-hmm. on our health care. And the other thing is, you know, we think about let's make things faster and easier. And even in school, they've eliminated recess places. There is a big move in places to get better food or healthier food into vending machines and to what they're feeding children to eat. So all this and it contributes to our health and the population's health. And we have to learn that we have to use judicious sources of judicious use of resources and to think about how sometimes we don't think about the environment and we pollute the environment. I mean, even you go on hikes now some places and people have dumped trash and stuff. Well, that's not helping us to, either because that gets into our system. Mm-hmm. And right now we have a crisis in antibiotic use, and we're looking at how organisms have become very, very resistant to antibiotics, and we think we use them in animals, and animals have waste that goes into the ground. We have groundwater there. We use we plant vegetables and other plants, and so it gets into our system. So we're intricately involved with the environment, and we should look back in time with nations and people that knew that there had to be an imbalance in the environment and to take care of it.
All right. Yeah. Thanks very much for clarifying that distinction. It's not all about health care that drives health for populations. But given all this, what we're discussing today is addressing these efforts to improve cost and quality in health care. Why should we be worried about cost and quality in the United States? What's the evidence for that?
Well, one thing is that there's studies that have been put out with the people that put together the Dartmouth Atlas, and they looked across the country at each state, and they looked at how health care was being delivered. And what they found out is the more that was spent on health care, the lower the quality. And so we're supposed to have the best health care in the world, but when you look around, if you have the best, that means that there might be one or two, maybe three different ways to do things the best way, and we should all be doing it. But the variation was so much that they thought, what's going on? And what you find out, depending on where you live, you look at utilization for different procedures such as x-rays and imaging and surgery and stuff. And what we're finding out is it didn't increase the quality. And so when people began to look at this, they found that there was also, when you use evidence that comes out in peer-reviewed journals, that there were procedures that were being done, and they cost money, but they really weren't improving our health care. So we needed to look around and see, oh, okay, what are we doing that's overutilization? Also, what are we doing that's wasteful? And also, the thing is, just because it's new, it doesn't mean it's the best thing. And we've got into the problem again when I said antibiotics. There are no antibiotics in the stream coming down for us to use, no new ones. And people think, well, the new ones come out, let's use that. But they're not always working either. And we have to look and see, oh, well, maybe some of those old medicines like penicillin, ampicillin, we know they can be used for things. And we have to, again, teach the public and even teach ourselves that, you know, for viral infections, you don't need an antibiotic. And no matter how much the patient beats you up, you have to give them an explanation of why they won't need it and why it isn't going to work. So we have to look around and find things that work. Make sure we use those, that we need to look at what's most efficient so we're not causing problems. before, everybody that went to surgery got a catheter, and now they don't because we found out that we're getting too many infections from leaving catheters in too long. It turns out that people have looked and for follow-up, say, to a kidney stone, if they want to look at you, they don't have to use a full-blown radiation on a CAT scan. They can use less, and that's good. Less radiation you get, the less the risk is for causing problems in the future. So when we look around, we can see, and people will also tell you stories about relatives or friends or someone they knew that got the wrong medication in the hospital. Sometimes it didn't cause a lot of problems, and sometimes it does. So that's what we were working on to fix.
All right. So there was there's evidence that even within the United States, there is different amounts of cost for healthcare that don't really correlate with increased quality. My understanding is that's also true internationally, where it's very understood that we spend far more on health care in the United States than other industrialized nations, and yet by the same markers of health, we are falling behind the rest of the country, which to me is another important bit of evidence that how much we spend is not what's important. It's that value that we get for the money we spend, not how much. And I think that's what you're saying, and I'm just trying to point out a little bit more evidence along the same line that you've already done a good job of doing. Does that make sense to you, and would you agree with that?
Oh, I agree with you, yes. I mean, the study's out there, and it's really interesting because Minnesota has very high-quality health care, and when you look, their costs are one of the lower places. So they've looked at overuse, underuse, and what they have is appropriate use. Nobody's perfect, but when you look around, it shows just what you said. The quality, as the quality has gone down, the costs have gone up, and that's probably from overutilization or utilization of things that don't work.
Let me take just a second, remind listeners, this is Line 1, your health connection. We're originating from Alaska Public Health, Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. My guest today is Dr. Nancy Fisher. She's the Chief Medical Officer for Region 10 Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and we're talking about changes in how Medicare is going to pay providers. And if you've got questions or comments, let me give you a couple of ways to get a hold of us in the next 50 minutes or so. Our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can always email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1 at alaskapublic.org. So having identified the fact that we could do better as a country in the value we're getting for our health care dollars, how did the government, let me put it that way, maybe specifically the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, go about trying to address this issue? What's the process that got us to this point?
Well, I can't give you the entire process about how the law came about, but CMS, you know, was mandated to implement the Affordable Care Act, or some people call it Obamacare. And in the law, it addresses multiple quality concerns, some of which I've mentioned. And in order to improve this, CMS looked at data to identify problems, looked for gaps in measures. They called experts together to look for recommendations for implementation of the law. And they looked at the problems that came up, such as the world was changing. There was rapid use of technology in other fields, but not in medicine. There was not as good a communication as you'd like between medical peers or between the staff and the facility. And it looking like there wasn't very great communication all the time with patients. And so when they looked at this, they thought, oh, this also affects the quality of care. Then they saw also, when they looked at problems, that there were devices and procedures that, when you used them, they didn't work. And there are many places where they are using to look at new devices and stuff at the evidence-based practices or organizations or university that evaluate new procedures and new methods to make sure that we're using what's appropriate and that what we're using is working. Also, the Affordable Care Act gave teeth to looking at fraud. And when I mean fraud, abuse, waste, and mistakes. And as you can see just recently in the news, there was a across-the-country sting on fraudulent medical care and billing for Medicare patients, and it amounted to $900 million. So this also is something, because if you use care, or say you have somebody else's Medicare number and you're using it for fraudulent use, the people say, I need a wheelchair, but somebody's already used my card and got my wheelchair. It makes it difficult to get the right care to the right people. The other thing that was learned is people have heard this PDSA, Plan, Do, Study, Act. And what you do is you implement a change in a small area, you evaluate it, you see where the bugs are that you want to get out of it, you put in something to fix those problems, then you implement it again, and you plan, do, study, act. And when you finally have it down to where you're satisfied that it works well, then you implement it into a larger population. And so this is one of the things we've looked at. Also, we have people that have looked at efficiency. What is the workflow, and what is going on? Are we sending people to the right facilities or to the right people? And then, you know, they began to look at what we call the basics. You know, you have all these infections in hospitals, and what's going on? And when it got down to it, you saw that people had forgotten what we learned 160 years ago about hand washing. And so they began to put out things about hand washing, and even saying to patients, empowering patients, ask your healthcare provider if they wash their hands, because it's like the basis of what goes on in medicine. Now, you know, when we look about the fact that we reduce preventable readmissions to the hospital, there are committees that also look at appropriate use of antibiotics, and they do these on cross-functional or cross-specialty teams so that everybody's working together and working on the same page. We know that we needed people to have health insurance so they could get access to care, because we were having inappropriate use of the emergency room. And there's information that goes out to the public to talk about, this is what's truly an emergency, this is what's urgent care, and this which can wait to go and see your clinician in the office the next day. And so when you start doing that and you have more efficient, appropriate use, then people that really have the emergencies get seen in the emergency room. People aren't sitting around. The other thing is that, you know, we have to keep working and keep working, and CMS has evaluated things, and even as I said, we have to get people to wash their hands. It hasn't worked as well as we thought, but we're always looking about a way to make progress and how to put this in initiatives so that we can, again, go back to having the highest quality of health care in the world.
What are the principal driving health care costs? I've seen several articles, I think maybe in the New England Journal of Medicine, where they look at some of the health economics. And I think the factors that are driving health care costs, at least I was a little surprised, and it would have not guessed these. So what? How do you understand the principal factors driving healthcare costs now in the United States?
You know, it's I've read several articles, and depending on where you are and what community you're in or what you're looking at, those factors may change. But one of the things that was talked about driving health care costs is we're growing older, we're growing fatter, and we're growing sicker, and we live longer. And, you know, our body parts wear out, like hips and knees, and we have to think about cancer as a disease of old age. Many cancers are curable, but they're costly. About half the population has chronic disease, such as asthma, heart disease, diabetes, and or depression. We're paying for volume of doing things, counting, rather than for value. So you're paying clinicians and also facilities to do more rather than be efficient or for quality of care. And, you know, we all think we want it all. We think that everything will be perfect if we can get the newest drug, use all the technologies, get services, get every procedure that we need, whether we need it or not. And when you do things to people, as you're well aware, there's a risk. And but you see on TV ads, they keep telling you over and over again, well, you need this. And the other thing is that what you see, too, is people go to the Internet, and anybody can put anything on the Internet, but it seems like, well, if it got on the Internet, it must be right. The other thing that seems to be driving healthcare costs is as hospitals and providers move into groups and larger groups, they're getting a larger share of the market, and some places they're monopolies, so they're demanding higher reimbursement. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, we get our insurance from employers, employment, and so it's not like we're really paying for it, so we don't look at our health care or as part of our budget and look to see, okay, you know, what do I really need? And it's like, well, it's free. I might as well use it. And then what we've discovered, too, when you talk about quality of care is that if we have primary care doctors, pediatricians, family practice doctors, internists, and if you have enough of them, they take care of people. They work in prevention. They know people individually. And what you find out is that, gee, the quality of care goes up and the costs go down. And so, you know, it's sort of like when you go to a primary care person, you go to a medical home. It's like Cheers, where everybody knows your name and they know you, and you get taken care of. And so when the reimbursement was increased for primary care, we saw quality go up. And then the other thing is we can't let go of is, too, is to look at legal issues. They vary from state to state. Some states have limited liability inappropriately. Some have mandated certain medical procedures, for example, maybe ones that don't work. And the jury has these awards that are really extraordinary. And so the thing is, when you look at this, all of these factors, and I'm sure I didn't mention all of them, are driving health care costs in the United States.
Right. One of the factors I was thinking you might mention, because it seems to me, because of our fractionated health care system and the way we do it, that administrative costs come in and take a big, big slice out of things. Does your understanding coincide with that, or do you think the administrative costs are not one of the principal drivers?
Well, I think that will vary depending on where you live. It's like looking at the cost of procedures across the United States. Mm-hmm. In some places, you can go and get laser lithotripsy for $8,500 is billed out. In other places, it's billed out at $32,000. Mm-hmm. And so what I see for administrative costs is, depending on where you are, the organization and their goals and what they're doing, some people will have administrative costs like 10%. Some people may have it 18%, 20%, 30%, and they can use creative accounting to hide this. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I would think that I wouldn't say that it mm-hmm. doesn't get in there, but there's all these other things. Even if it was 25%, what's the other 75%? But that can contribute to it, especially. Let's say that if you have a large number of vice presidents or whatever, and they're being paid high salaries and stuff.
Okay. You know, I think, Dr. Fisher, this is the best time from my point of view to take our half break. We're moving pretty quickly. We've got a lot of background about why we're going to move or where the effort to move away from fee-for-service. And I want to take our break for about a minute now and then come back and begin to talk about fee-for-service and how payment to physicians is going to change based on the background we've got. So let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number again, 550-8433, toll-free 1-888. 353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and continue our discussion on coming changes in Medicare payments to physicians with Dr. Nancy Fisher. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Nancy Fisher. She's joining us from her office, where she is the Chief Medical Officer for Region 10 for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. We're discussing one of the changes that came about as a result of the Affordable Care Act, or the Accountable Care Act. Boy, I do that every time. The Accountable Care Act, or the Affordable Care Act. I always get it backwards. My fault. The effort to explore the alternative payment mechanism. So part of the Affordable Care Act was the effort to explore alternative payment mechanisms for providers. And the hope is that payment for the prevention of illness and looking at value and quality will help control healthcare costs. If you've got questions or comments, you can email us during the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433 and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And as you just heard, please remember that if you're listening between 8 and 9 on a Monday evening, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. One other comment before we get back to the program. On alaskapublic.org, if you find the Line 1 link, there is a link to Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Quality of Care Center. Also, there's been a special communication by President Obama to the Journal of the American Medical Association, which really does a good job, along with his comments and some corresponding editorials about healthcare reform, where we're going, and at least his suggestions on where we should be making our next steps. Finally, for those listeners who are wanting to know more information about Medicare in general, you can get information about doctors who take Medicare and how Medicare works. If that's a question, at the Medicare Information Office locally, 907-269-3680. Dr. Fisher, so let's get back to the meat of the program and why we're driving for change. And I'm going to take a quote out of the website, and it says the strategic vision of CMS is evolving an approach to provide provider payment and that CMS, which is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, along with the private sector, continues to drive away from purely fee-for-service payment system to payment models that reward providers based on quality and cost of care provided, such as value-based purchasing and other alternative payment models. So they're trying to measure different quality indicators and expand the use of outcome measures and incorporation of population-based measures as ways to look at how providers are going to be paid in the future. So can we address the problems for fee-for-service? What is it about fee-for-service that is not as good as, it's not driving us in the direction it appears we need to if we're going to be looking at cost and quality?
Well, if you think about fee-for-service, if I go and I do something, and it's easy to count, say a procedure, and if I do one, I get paid a certain amount of money. Gee, if I do two, I get paid more. And so you will see people doing, a lot of, let's say, scopes for gastrointestinal problems when if what you could have done first before you did the scope was start somebody on an antibiotic, like if you were expecting an ulcer or you're worried about things, but people, I'll get paid more if I scope first. And so when you're doing that and you're paying for things based on how you can count them and what's real and tangible, then what you're doing is you're paying for volume and you're not looking to see is the care efficient, was it the best thing done, but you get into a habit of just paying for the procedure. It's true that when you have an office and you stop and you think about it, there are some things like we were talking about, social determinants of health, that are important in healthcare. But if you're not paying someone to do that, they're not going to do it because they still have their overhead to meet. Or even if you paid for it and it was really lower reimbursement, you've got to figure out how you're going to meet your overhead. So when you have things like that with fee-for-service, you're looking at volume, and you know you can think about another business how people say, well, I'll make it up in volume, and that's how I'll make up the money. And so, but you still, when you look at taking care of people have, they're not widgets, and they have complicated problems, and it's complex to take care of health care. And you have to say that we are not reimbursing for everything that some people may need in improving their health.
The way I like to think of it in addition is we're incentivized in a fee-for-service to do certain things, but the outcomes doesn't really make a difference. As you implied, if you don't get better or you get readmitted to the hospital, the system still continues to make money, whereas what you want to try to do is incentivize that no mistakes are made or less likely you're going to end up back in the hospital or less likely that you're going to need high cost care and so forth. So that the fee-for-service really doesn't incentivize, when you think about it, what we should be doing. Does that make sense to you? I keep thinking of, we all do, humans are animals, and we do what we're incentivized to do, and the fee-for-service system, I think people are doing exactly what they're incentivized to be doing, and we need to change the incentives. Does that make sense?
Yes, and it's how things work. The more you do, the more you get paid for. The sicker the patient, the more you get paid. And so you don't think about, about what the outcome is, and even some facilities or things, you're being incentivized to do things, and so that you do them. There are some things that we need to incentivize people to do that we're not paying for. We're both on the same page about that.
What are some examples of payment systems that may stress more quality and cost, so that listeners can get an understanding of what we are trying to move towards?
Well, what we're trying to move towards is when we talk about alternative payment models is we really want to look at a condition, and we want to have payment based on a condition, not on what you're treating them with. And, you know, I can give an example of that. I think we've done that before. Let's say that you're pregnant and you go in and you have a vaginal delivery. Well, the reimbursement for the vaginal delivery, straight vaginal delivery, is the same. And then some are real easy and some are harder. But you're getting paid the same thing. And the idea is that as the physician, you're going to do everything in your power to make sure that this doesn't end up being a complication when you're doing it, because you're not going to get any more money for, you know, the vaginal delivery. I'm not saying not be something else that you had no control over, but the idea is to bundle payment and to do it on the condition. Or you decide to look at it and you say, okay, let's pay for an episode of care. So say that you decide, okay, we're only going to pay so much after looking back and looking at data to see what it costs for knee replacements. So we're going to bundle the payment for when you come into the hospital, and it maybe you want to end it when they leave the hospital, or maybe so many days after when you get post-treatment. And what that does is that incentivizes people to do the best care they can, because they're going to get the same amount for taking care of that problem. And one of the other things is we don't want to pay people who come into the hospital and get sicker. And so they're looking at, or we've been looking at, what condition were you in when you came into the hospital? Did you have this terrible infection? If you didn't have it and you got it in the hospital, you're not going to get paid more money for that. And, you know, many of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation have programs that have been looking to pay this way. We have the accountable care organizations, and they're being paid a set amount to take care of people. So people look at how is the best way to take care of people. And some people will need more expensive services, and some will need less. But this is one of the things we're looking at when we talk about alternative payments. Or you may say, okay, this is a benchmark or this is the standard, and we try to get people to look, okay, this is the standard, this is the benchmark, let's work towards that. And you get paid a certain amount if you make it.
So there's a number of different mechanisms whereby the government and payers are exploring ways to encourage the incentivization to keep costs and quality down, either being paid for quality indicators or getting paid a lump sum amount of money for a care, and then you save some money if you don't use all that money, but you're going to lose money if people end up spending more of that amount of money that was allotted for that particular service. Those are some of the ideas that are being experimented with and played with to see what's going to work the best.
That's true. And there are probably other things that we haven't looked at yet, and we're going to give the medical community a chance in the future to look and see what kind of payment will work the best for whatever their problems are for, they're having. And when you stop and you think about these payments, think about things like low back pain. Who should see the person with low back pain? The orthopedic surgeon, the neurosurgeon, the family practice or the primary care doctor, or physical therapy? Mm-hmm. Who's supposed to see that? Mm-hmm. Should people that are specialized and taught to do ENT, ears, nose, and throat surgery, really should be taking care of sinusitis? Shouldn't they be doing the surgery and say that the primary care people can see people for sinusitis, and then if it gets to be more difficult, then you would refer them on? So we have to look at all those aspects And we also have to consider the situation you're in. If you're in a clinic or you're in a place where you can refer to specialists, then you can look at the workload or the workflow. But if you're out by yourself in a rural or frontier community or something like that, you have to look at what those circumstances are and what would work best for them.
Okay. One of the mechanisms to look at this that came out of the MACRA Act that I talked about earlier, the Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act, which I want to again comment, mm-hmm. which was a bipartisan act, introduces this idea of merit-based incentive payment system, which is, and you may want to correct me, but for Medicare, physicians who are seeing Medicare patients. Could you describe that? This is pretty much more for physicians who may be listening, but also the public who wants to understand it, and how that may differ from the current reporting systems that physicians are under right now.
Well, right now, if you look up, there are three sort of main reporting systems that physicians are under. We started out with electronic health records or medical records, and there were measures to report specifically for use of that because people were getting help to put in electronic health records. We started out with a system called Physician Quality Reporting Initiative, and people were paid for reporting, and then after several years, it became PQRS, Physician Quality Reporting System, where eligible physicians reported on quality measures, we were paying for quality, and that was on how often they met the specific measure. The other thing is using the data from PQRS, there was a value modifier. And the idea with the better value modifier is we could give a differential payment to a physician or a group practice that was under Medicare fee-for-service based on the quality of care they were giving compared to the cost of care defined over, you know, a specific period of time. So we were paying based on performance. Each one of those, the electronic health record, PQRS, the value modifier, had their own measures that you had to report on. And over time, there was an effort to make those measures the same to reduce the clinician's burden. But with MACRA and bringing in what we call MIPS, the incentive program, these three separate reporting systems are being brought into one thing and being called MIPS, and the measures that the doctors get to pick, right, when you start out, I should say, the physicians, they can pick what's appropriate most for their practice, and they're not reporting to three different systems. So what it is a way to still look at basic quality measures, but to put it under one system to reduce the administration costs that go along with reporting to three systems, reduce the time, and it in turn reduces the burden on the clinician.
And so they're now being paid, or I'm thinking in my mind, incentivized, as I understand it, the MIPS system, or the merit-based incentive payment system, is going to look at quality performance, advancing care and information, clinical practice improvement, and resource use, and various amounts mm-hmm. reimbursed. And so we're trying to drive physician actions by reimbursing for documentation that they're doing these particular aspects that are felt to be good quality and should lead to cost savings.
I guess, yes. And when you look at what we're looking at first, what do we really want? We want to improve and keep on improving quality. So these four categories that are being looked at, quality, resource use, clinical practice improvement, and advancing care, they're weighted. And when it starts out, the emphasis is being put on quality. The other thing is you want to look at, you know, the clinical practice improvement. And so they've weighted these so that what's important, people will pay attention to more, you know, more often. I mean, if you're looking at something and it's going to be weighted, and it's half of it, you're really going to pay attention to it because it's like you said, you know, doctors are human too. So the quality performance starts out at about 50% of what they're looking at in MIPS, and advancing care information is 25%, clinical practice improvements 15%, and resource use is 10%. And over time, what happens is the quality performance will gradually go down to 30%, and the advancing care will be 30%. So the idea is that we feel that people will improve, and so let's look at how we're going to weight these and what we want people to do. What do we want them to incentivize them to do?
There is, if you look at the newsletters that physicians get, there's a lot of angst about this change. Basically, it revolves around things like the cost to do this, particularly for smaller individual practices, which may feel they have to join larger practices just to do the accounting and reporting requirements. And then there's always this aspect that physicians have is, even if I do the right thing, I can't control everything the patient does, so I may have, I may get docked, I may not get paid as well as I could for factors I can't control. I think those are two big issues that drive physicians. How would you respond to those concerns?
Well, one thing, we said that we are streamlining, so you're not reporting to three systems, you're reporting to one, and we've gone down in the number of measures that you're going to have to report on. And so if you're doing less reporting, and we've consolidated this, then the cost should be less. I mean, when you start out and it's something new, I'm sure that what you would say is it's going to take time to learn it. But it was like many physicians with the electronic medical record. They knew that they wouldn't be bringing in as much money in the beginning, but now I hear from people, yeah, we've got it, and it's become part of our daily practice, and we do this. I think where this can be a problem is if you don't have an electronic medical record now and you're going to put one in, the time where we were paying for people to have electronic medical records is gone. So that would be one that would be driving a big expense. And I think with anything, when you bring in change, none of us wants it. You know, it's always, yeah, we want the change, we know we need it, but let somebody else do it and not me. And there is a learning curve with everything, but, you know, once people seem to get into it and get the hang of it and to do it, it wasn't as bad as it seemed.
If you don't mind, I'd like to address also this idea of patients that physicians worry that they don't have complete control of outcomes, so that outcome measures may depend somewhat on not only the patient's willingness to go along with the recommended or evidence-based information. And then there's also, kind of along the same line, there's this issue of, yeah, we definitely want, I don't think anybody could argue about very good evidence of quality. But then you think about that for a second, and then you get the issue, well, whose quality are we talking about? The healthcare system's quality or the patient's quality? And an example I've been using recently when I'm talking to lay public about the changes that I see coming is, let's say you have a patient with diabetes, and the quality indicator for your practice might be is how many patients are you doing a very good monitoring of their diabetes. What is their hemoglobin A1C? And I won't get into what that is for everybody, but let's say we have this marker that we have to measure ever so often, and that's a quality indicator, and it makes sense to do it for most patients. But one of your patients, or maybe a handful of your patients, if depending on what practice is, maybe they're 80 or 90-year-old patients who have diabetes, but they're also dying of a malignancy or another disease, and the last thing they're particularly worried about at that particular time is getting their hemoglobin A1C. They're much more interested in their quality of life overall as they are passing away. And so physicians are worried that they would get docked again for not addressing the quality indicator as it is, but really trying to help the patient meet their quality of life needs. So the quality, it looks different from where you're looking. How are those kinds of philosophical or real issues going to be addressed?
Well, when you stop and we look at it, you know, you have to meet a certain volume, and with everything, nothing is 100%. So okay. Hopefully you have a whole practice of 90-year-old people right. who have diabetes and you can't get their hemoglobin A1C. Mm-hmm. What I see is a sort of an issue is what we want is a medical home. And if you have a medical home, then the doctor gets to know the patient and gets to work with the patient. And so I can understand people like you were saying about the person that's dying and they don't want a hemoglobin A1C, or the idea is if you're 80 some years old and you're in a wheelchair and say you've got breast cancer, you don't want a radical mastectomy because you can't move your wheelchair. I think what we have to spend more time with and to sit down and talk to people is so that they understand what are the risks. You know, younger people who you may give them medicine, say for antibiotics for a urinary tract infection, and they go and read the complications, and so they read all these complications. So I'm not going to take this medicine. And the thing is, they don't understand about what is the complication. There may be a complication that's one in a million on there. They don't know how to evaluate that. And so when you have a relationship with the patient, I think it's those patients that are really going along and really looking at, you know, going on their own, but they really don't understand what's been put into it. If you have a relationship, you can come to an understanding, and they can understand that this complication, say from a urinary tract infection, you could be 79 years of old and you could get sepsis and die from it. You're not as strong as you were when you were 20 years of age. And so we have to build those relationships. Other things that is also taken into account with this is what we call shared decision making. And there are even guidelines out for certain diseases about how to do this, because what we may want personally, like you said, doesn't increase the quality of life for the individual that you're talking to. You know, you would feel different about getting treatment for certain diseases based on whether you're 37 or whether you think, well, I've led this full life. And the thing at 90 about that patient is that hopefully, I mean, your whole practice isn't that way. So that's just a small number. And you do have, responsibility to sit down and see what is important to this person in the last days or months of their life. And we have to approach that too, and to do what we think is best. I mean, the patient's not really asking for something that's unreasonable. Mm-hmm. I mean, what you usually run into is the family that can't let go of the patient. But you got to think about the patient, and I think that's when we come into this shared decision making.
You know, when I think about this in the big picture, and by the way, we've really on our last 3 minutes, so I want to keep you abreast of the time here that we have left. Is that, you know, physicians, like everybody else, want to do the right thing. most of us most of the time, and there's going to be those who are going to do some fraudulent stuff, but we're all hoping and trying our best to do the right thing. And human nature is to think we're all pretty good at what we do, but we're not all pretty good at everything we do, and we really all could benefit from some efforts to try to make sure that we're keeping up with the changes and using value-based and evidence-based information to make decisions. So in general, I kind of like this, but it really is a difficult thing to push on to people just because of our natural self-esteem, that we don't want to think that we need help in making decisions as much as we all can benefit from understanding a little bit more. So it gets back to this change is difficult issue as well, it seems to me, in a big way. Well, I really have appreciated your taking the time. Hopefully, people can understand where we're going and why we're going in the direction we're going. And we've really only talked about Medicare, but it is expected that normal health insurance programs and Medicaid will move in the same way. Is that your understanding?
Yes, health insurance plans tend to do things that Medicare does, and especially if it is helping them, you know, with patients. And, you know, the healthier we keep patients, the better. Medicaid does sometime, but as we have to remember, Medicaid is a state-run program. And so if you know one Medicaid program, you know one Medicaid program. So while they try to align, they also have their own laws for each state and budgetary limitations or appropriations that they have to look at. But in the end, we seem to somehow come to finding ways to do things so that people get appropriate care, because we want people to be healthy, and we know that we're all in this together.
Dr. Fisher, once again, thanks very much for taking the time to joining us here at Line One, your health connection. We appreciate all the information you provided. I want you to have a good evening.
Same to you, and thank you for inviting me.
You betcha. All right, my guest today was Nancy Fisher, Dr. Nancy Fisher. She's Chief Medical Officer for Region 10 of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. If our listeners would like to continue this discussion on provider payment reform, you can certainly join KSK on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website at www.alaskapublic.org, where you also can find the Line 1 archives. You can also let us know your thoughts and suggestions at our email, line1@alaskapublic.org. Those of you who are regular listeners probably are beginning to understand that the last program of each month is dedicated to emotional, behavioral, or psychological issues, and it's usually hosted by our co-host, Dr. Prentice Pemberton, or Prentice Pemberton, who's a medical social worker. Licensed clinical social worker. And to our next program, you can join Prentice on Line 1, Your Health Connection, Monday, July 25th at 2 p.m. And there'll be a discussion at that time with a clinical psychologist, Dr. Jennifer Beath, on one of our probably most important emotions, love. So if you'd like to get a better understanding of that, join Prentice on July 25th on Line 1. Remember, we repeat each evening at 8 p.m. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron audio engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.